Hello, my name's Steve Wasserman, and welcome to another session from Short Story Masterclass, talking with great short story writers about the craft, even the craftiness, perhaps, of the modern short story. I'm here in Charleston at Small Wonder, a whole festival dedicated to short stories. And it's a Sunday afternoon, the weather's turned penumbral, autumnal, which perhaps suits the territory we're going to explore with David Van in a moment. If there are small children present, you might want to send them out of the room or invite them to listen very carefully as David begins with a short passage from his story Ichthology, which is to be found in a collection that's fast becoming a modern classic, I think, Legend of a Suicide.
From Ichthyology. Everything in human life was to be found in that tank. Yellow and black angelfish floated delicately by, all glamour and glitz, while behind them trailed their waste in streamers. Suckers at the bottom of the tank ate this waste, spat it out in disgust, and roved on, still hungry. And within 5 minutes of placing 2 new silver dollars in the tank, I saw real brutality. These silver dollars were large, thin fish, nearly identical in shape and shine to the coins after which they had been named, and once out of their plastic bag from cells, they swam up on either side of my one lazy, boggle-eyed iridescent shark. This iridescent shark had been badly misnamed. He was, in actuality, no more than a long, thin goldfish with a shiny body and 2 large, bulbous eyes. The silver dollars were slick and merciless and knew how to work as a team. In one quick flash, each went for an eye and sucked it out. They didn't even swallow, but let the round, billiard ball eyes float dreamily down to the rocks, where they were ingested by the suckerfish. My mother was swift in her retribution. The silver dollars were netted and flushed within minutes, and we spent that evening together watching the iridescent shark bump blindly into the sides of the tank, waiting for him to die.
So David, rereading the stories, because the last time I read them was a couple of years ago, I was really struck this time round by how every story leading up to that central long story has at some point in it a moment of just senseless violence which kind of pulls the rug out from underneath the reader in a kind of scary but also slightly thrilling way. There's almost a Tarantino-esque quality to the violence. It's kind of like, you know, sort of almost cartoonish in a way. And I was just wondering, I mean, did you consciously build those moments into the stories?
I think it's a really smart comment, observation. It's true that my father's suicide had a kind of gravitational pull on all of my stories, and so they tend to have these kind of violent moments where everything's broken. There's a taboo crossed, or the rules that are supposed to hold people together are broken apart. And there's a suddenness to all of it, because his death in real life was sudden. It just happened one day, and suddenly he was gone. It didn't make any sense, really. But in terms of having any plan or idea when I set out, the truth is that it was just a mess, the 10 years of trying to write about my father. I had no idea what I was doing. So most of the stories that I spent my time on and did many drafts of became Frankensteins and were thrown away. Everything that's published in the book was actually written very quickly, with the exception of maybe the second and third stories, Rhoda and Legend of Good Men. Those I had many drafts and went over. But Ichthyology was the first time I experienced writing quickly, where I wrote it at 3 a.m. after telling jokes to my roommates, comparing myself to a fish as a boy, and wrote most of the story just at 3 a.m., and then woke up and finished it, and that was it. It's the first time publishing anything, but also the first time of experiencing something being finished with only one paragraph added and one paragraph cut.
So there's a sense of flow.
Yeah, that's something that writing for me is about failure over a long time, not being able to tell stories, but then when they do happen, they happen very quickly and they're published the same as the first draft. So all of my most recent books, Goat Mountain that just came out, and Dirt before that, and Caribou Island, were written 5.5 months with only a couple paragraphs added to Caribou Island and Dirt, nothing added to Goat Mountain, published the same as the first draft. And it's what I first experienced with Ichthyology, and then with Suquan Island. Suquan Island, which is the bulk of Legend of a Suicide, I wrote half of that in 17 days sailing from California to Hawaii. And I had failed for 10 years throwing away stuff about my father, and it hadn't cohered into any kind of book with any kind of pattern. I only had a handful of stories I could keep out of that time period. And then suddenly I wrote that, and it was a strange experience of sailing offshore, not sleeping more than 45 minutes at a time, reading Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. At night, the boat looked like a kind of dragon with the red eyes and all the sails out and the bioluminescence. I had these paranoid dreams of rocks rising up suddenly that weren't on the chart and we'd all be dead. And so it was a strange kind of time period where maybe I was knocked out of my usual pattern and it was possible to write more unconsciously.
Was that happening in the period that you write about in A Mile Down, where you were trying to do these cruises and it was all just sort of going pear-shaped, as we would say?
Right.
Literally, right. But I mean, in a kind of totally compelling, catastrophic way. It's one of my favorite of your books, by the way. Was that actually in the midst of that?
It was
disintegration that you were writing.
It was right. It was right at the beginning of the disintegration.
Right.
I was a Stegner Fellow at Stanford. I realized I would never get a professorship. That I couldn't get my book published. Legend of Suicide. At that point, was just stories, and it. I don't really blame people for not wanting it. It didn't have Suquan Island yet, and there wasn't much to how the stories would be organized. But I freaked out, basically, and thought, God, I have to make some money. I need some other kind of job. Like, this is not going to work. So I started the sailing stuff, but right at the beginning of it, before it totally took over my life and made me not write for 5.5 years, at first it unsettled me in a good way, I think, and led to making it possible to write Suquan Island. And it was halfway through Suquan Island that the really surprising event that happens in the middle, it was that moment that changed everything that I thought about writing. That was the end of me thinking that writing was about control and structure and having an outline or a plan or knowing what the thing was going to be about. That moment destroyed all my plans for that piece and made me see all this pattern and pressure that it was leading there. It was almost as if someone else had written the pages. I was seeing them for the first time. And then that changed forever what I thought about writing. So now I think an idea is the worst thing that can happen to a writer, and I try not to have any of them, and I don't have any outline or plan, and I just find out each day what's going to happen.
Mm. Now, I mean, this is really interesting because you are also a creative writing teacher, and you're just about to embark on this 10-week term at Warwick. And I was wondering if there are certain kind of golden rules, as it were, that you try to impart to your student. I mean, do you have the sort of Van 10 Commandments or even the Van 5 Commandments?
Yeah, I actually wrote a piece for Book Trust, which has I think it was for Book Trust, has my tips on short story writing, whatever. I think it was 12 or 15
or
something.
Okay, we'll link to those. Right.
And it does kind of list all of those.
And is one of those, which is very sort of counter the received notion about what creative writing about. I mean, is one of those kind of first thought, best thought, or trust the first draft? Because that's essentially what you seem to be saying. Trust the flow, trust the energy of a first draft.
Well, I think that fiction is real, that it's not faked, that it's an act of transformation by the unconscious that happens on the page, and that's why you can't know it ahead of time, why outlines or plans ahead of time are worthless, because they can't take into account what that transformation is going to be. And all writing is about vision. That's why we read it. It's because it's about shift and vision. And those transformations are moments where we get past our conscious mind and get access to some other pattern, some coherence that's beyond what we were consciously thinking. So those, to me, are the exciting moments, and they come about for me through landscape description. When I describe a forest or water, Alaska or California, landscape is interesting to read when it points to the inside life of a character and to shift in vision. So in a way, since we get caught up in the characters and their conflicts, the landscape should disappear in that sort of way. But it is foregrounded quite a lot in the book, so I think increasingly, especially my new novel, Goat Mountain, you'd really notice the landscape in the front. When I teach students, I'm not prescriptive. I don't think that they have to write the same way that I write. And I think this is a strange way to go about writing Greek tragedy, to write it through landscape. You don't have any landscape description on a stage. So it's a very strange way to write a Greek tragedy. So I think each of us comes to the best approach to our material based on the works that we've loved and reread and ingested, and language we've studied, and what our failures have been as we've tried to write our stories before, and what our whole family backgrounds are. So it's kind of a mosh. For students, I really teach them only that subtext is the one rule you can't break. That I had a class with Grace Paley where she said, every good story is at least two stories. And this is an unbreakable rule, I think. Online, blogs are not two stories. They tend to be one story. Almost everything online tends to be one story. It's the largest mountain of shit ever created. And the bummer is that all these readers are getting used to reading nothing. That if there's not subtext, if there's not a second story that we're reading for, we're actually not reading in that literary sense. And so I think we're losing readers because of that. So I think that's the only unbreakable rule. I think anything that doesn't have subtext, that doesn't have a second story, something else we're looking for or reading for, that it is shit, all of it, without an exception. I can't think of a single exception for anything I've ever read. There's no flat, single account of something that's not about something else that's good. So that's the only unbreakable rule, I think. All the others can be broken, and what I do in teaching is to set up the short story as a paranoid world and talk about all the rules of that world, what makes a short story. Then at the end of the semester, I bring in a bunch of readings that break those rules to show by the end you can do what you want, that beyond there needing to be a second story, there's really no other rule. So I begin with talking about the structure of short stories as paranoid, cohesive world, with talking about Nabokov's Signs and Symbols. I mean, I'm actually lying here, I guess, and I just looked at my syllabus because I teach this week, and that's not actually the piece we begin with. We begin with style and the English language. I teach a bit of history of that. So I look at talking about Latin and Old English and Middle English, and looking at stylists, Annie Proulx, Marilyn Robinson, and Cormac McCarthy for describing language. And then I talk about the protagonist. After that, with Flannery O'Connor and Chekhov and others, for the idea that there's one character at the center who has a problem, who's divided about that, and then story, everything's arranged about that, around that. But then I get to Nabokov, who describes this protagonist as having referential mania, a mental illness in which everything refers to him or her. And that, I do think, describes to me how short stories work, that they are these paranoid, cohesive worlds. And that they're all about shift in vision. They're about how that character sees the world and themselves and others differently by the end.
Mm. I wonder if some of that shifting vision, and some of that two-sidedness that you mentioned in reference to Grace Paley, has to do with also moving between, could we say, two different worlds or two different genres or two different psychological states, that of fiction and non-fiction. Because what I particularly love about your writing is there is a kind of an energy about a lot of it where, and I believe that this energy comes from finding oneself in this kind of liminal space between so-called fiction and non-fiction, which gives, I think, the writing a kind of added frisson and intimacy, but also there's also a vulnerability there because there is this transparency that you have about where the material starts from. So my sense is that this creates a particular kind of energy, a kind of emotional veracity in the prose that inhabits this strange liminal space. I mean, where do you stand on, would you agree with that?
Thank you, it's very nice. For my first four books of fiction, they do all have family stories in the background, and they borrow their emotional and psychological weight from those stories. And so my sense of how that happens, how it finds its way into the prose, is that for 30 years, these have been disturbing stories. The stories about the breaking apart of all the lives of my family. Taboos crossed and rules broken and all that. And my mind or my unconscious has made a, tried to make sense of that, has tried to shape that, everything that was terrifying and incoherent and without pattern or shape. And when that collides in writing a new page, collides with language I've studied and literary forms, what I've read and reread, there's I guess it's exactly what you said. The nonfiction part, the true story, is powering what happens on the surface in this invented fiction. But I don't think that that has to be the case. After this, I've written a novel about Medea, and to me that had the same kind of power to it, just because I cared about her story, and I've cared about her story for 25 years. So I think it's possible to care about someone else's story in a story from fiction, from myth, that it doesn't have to be from nonfiction. I think there just has to be some attachment. There has to be some weight to what happens in the characters. And I don't think that it has to come through nonfiction. And when I'm writing nonfiction, I actually feel a limitation, because I can't make up character or event, because I can't head toward transformation. There, everything remains more flat. And there are great nonfiction writers who obviously get around this problem. But for me, I felt more limited in all three nonfiction books that I've written, where I just couldn't get them to really take off because I wasn't free to follow transformations and follow the strangeness of what might happen.
Including A Mile Down.
Yeah, A Mile Down is written completely differently than all of my other books. I wrote 300,000 words and then cut out 100,000, which became a second sailing memoir called Crocodile that'll come out in Spanish first. And then I was left with 204,000 words, I think it was, and cut it down to 76,000. So it was a process of just chopping away and chopping away to get down to what it is. And so it has a kind of compression to it. And my real life experience was interesting. I mean, my wife and I sank in a freak storm in the Caribbean on our honeymoon and lost everything after we had all these funny and awful disasters in Turkey and the construction and losing a rudder off Morocco. And, you know, there's a lot that happened. But the story...
But it's more than that. It's more. I mean, the way you're putting it sounds almost like a sort of a Shaggy Dog story. But it's. I mean, it's. It has these huge, sort of tragedy shaped dimensions.
Yeah,
to
it's about a life out of control. Reliving my father's life without knowing I was doing it. Going to sea to repeat his disasters. Perhaps to get myself to the point of testing whether I'd kill myself, as he had that kind of sense of a legacy. I mean, it does have those kind of currents in it. And to me, it's interesting as a tale of a life that's led like Greek tragedy, out of control, acting unconsciously, not knowing why I'm doing what I'm doing, having no idea why I'm making the big decisions.
Yeah.
So to me, it's interesting in that way. And that does give it an unconscious and out of control sense. You're right. And so maybe I'm giving it short shrift.
But unlike Greek tragedy, it's... For me, it's also a narrative about resilience, you know, and Greek tragedy is in a way about, to a certain extent, caving in to one's inevitable, awful fate. Right. Whereas, in fact, you know, you don't. Mm-hmm. And that feels, I recognize that there's a truth there, but that also feels like it's a kind of, that you shaped the piece in that way.
Well, thank you. It's some of the only perhaps kind words I've heard about him. That I mean, I heard nice things from Toby Wolfe and his brother Jeffrey Wolfe, who like had a nice time reading it and got to laugh about the adventures and stuff, and some other writers. But generally, it wasn't reviewed as literature when it came out. It was just reviewed by sailing magazines, who universally said, it's a fast read, I read it in a day, and what an asshole this guy is. They all said the same thing. So my first experience of having a book come out was that, you know, I'm just reviewed in these kind of shoddy places that talked about what a jerk I was. So thank you.
It's
really nice to hear.
I think it's one of your best pieces of writing. I you know, when people say to me, I really like David Van, I always say, have you read A Mile Down? Because I just think it's fantastic. But there you go.
Well, it was funny to actually have a life so out of control. And it was entertaining to write it in some ways, and disturbing in some ways. But yeah, I feel more freedom in fiction. I've turned to that. I've now written, 5 novels since then. Or 6 novels, actually, since then. So I haven't really gone back to nonfiction. I've written one nonfiction book about a school shooting, which is investigative journalism, which is another thing entirely. I include some of my memoir in there to try to not make the shooter a monster, to understand how close I came to being him. But other than that, it's investigative journalism.
Mm. I mean, I can see there where you might feel that you were limited also because that was... Who was that originally written for? That was originally
Esquire,
yeah. And I imagine there would be a lot of fact-checking going on there.
So, oh, huge fact-checking, incredible.
You know, you couldn't get away with being creative.
Well, it was huge fact-checking, but then my editor made me write a scene at the beginning where I imagine him in the hotel room, but I don't say I imagine him. I just say he's sitting there, he's got his guns and such. And I knew all the materials in the room, everything he had, what he was wearing, his guns, but I don't know if he sat on the bed before leaving the hotel room. No one knows. And my editor made me put that in. We had a huge falling out over it. And so it begins with something which a reader can tell is just guesswork, which is terrible because the entire rest of the piece is all fact. I actually made up nothing. It's all fact. And so to have all that investigative work really doubted because of an editor's decision to add the stupid scene up front, it's very frustrating. I've also stopped writing for magazines because I'm just so sick of editors adding stupid shit and cutting stuff that can't be cut. They don't realize it, how it connects four places elsewhere in the piece because they actually don't know how to read very well and don't know how to write. I just can't do it anymore. It's unbearable.
Mm. Now, sort of coming back to this idea of processing the facts, the things that have happened in our life into fiction, I wonder if there is a way in which it's sort of similar as a kind of a metaphor to what happens in A Legend of Good Men, where the narrator loses his keys and he breaks into his own mm-hmm. house mm-hmm. and starts to see his own life through the eyes of another person, through the eyes of someone who's broken in. I wonder if you could maybe read that passage.
Yeah.
It's just there.
Okay. In early fall, post-Merrill, when my mother wasn't dating anyone, when it was just the two of us, I broke into our own house. I had left the key hanging in my locker at school. We didn't have a spare hidden under the welcome mat anymore, and my mother rarely made it home before 6 or 7. So I checked all our windows and doors, and when I could find nothing that was open, I picked up a flat gray rock from our yard and smashed it through her bathroom window. I unscrewed the lock, slid the pane aside, and crawled in. I checked the master bedroom first. I found 16 paper bags in the closet, filled with everything from school papers to clothing to spare batteries. The inevitable rings were hidden in shoes, wrapped up in nylons. The only safe was a toy one for a child, with the combination printed plainly on the bottom. Bras and panties were hanging from clothespins, but there were no ties, so clearly this room was without men. In the bathroom, a single purple toothbrush hung from the wall, the fact of a diaphragm in the cupboard by the sink had not been noticed before. This woman's teeth were brittle, or else she ground them together at night, because in that same cupboard she had both Sensodyne toothpaste and a plastic mouthpiece for sleeping. This woman kept no pictures of anyone on display, so it was hard to tell whether she had a family. In the only other bedroom, the wallpaper was a print of bamboo thatching that covered even the ceiling. In the corner was a fish tank with the light turned off and a poster listing 250 species of shark. The shark poster and the small pairs of white Fruit of the Loom underwear strewn about the floor suggested that a boy or several boys lived in this room. The single pair of hiking boots in the closet, as well as the single pair of soccer cleats, narrowed it to one boy. The guns in his closet, a Browning 22 caliber rifle, a 30-30 Winchester carbine, a 300 Winchester magnum with scope, a Winchester Model 25 12-gauge pump shotgun, a Sheridan Blue Streak pellet rifle, and a Ruger 44 Magnum handgun were difficult to explain. Where had he gotten them all? The buildup of carbon in the chamber of the 300 Magnum indicated that the gun had been used frequently, perhaps even recently. The block of wood under his bed, shot full of holes that didn't go all the way through, suggested that he not only had fired the 22, but may even have fired it inside the house. The box full of Playboys, penthouses, hustlers, and trash novels with adults only on the cover suggested that this boy was some kind of pervert, and why he kept so many pictures of his father in the same box, but not on his desk or on his walls, didn't make much sense. Right around that time, after looking through that box, I loaded my father's 12-gauge and blew out most of our windows and doors. It was a fairly extreme thing to do, I realized afterward. I went through 2.5 boxes of shells before I was done. The front doors especially took a lot of rounds, one for each hinge, plus 2 more to knock them over. The sliding glass door in our family room was by far the most beautiful. I blew one small hole through its middle, about the size of a half dollar. Everything was absolutely still for a moment, then the glass began to tremble. It rippled and shook its entire length, the glass bending in waves, then it shattered into a billion fibers.
That's fantastic, thank you. Now, I mean, there's a lot going on there, but one thing that I take away from that passage is how we live with shame. I mean, there seems to be a lot of shame there, shame around, you know, finding your mother's diaphragm, one's teenage reading material, one's own sort of inner anger and conflict and, you know, shooting the... And I was almost wondering if, to some extent, after reading that, I was wondering if in some way fiction is almost then like an evolutionary impulse that has been that we've kind of developed in some way to almost distance ourselves from, or to get some distance on kind of shame. I mean, does that resonate in any way?
I do think that the writing process that I've been talking about, where it's unconscious and there's transformations on the page that are surprising each day, that it is a way of getting distance, just as the boy sneaks into his house and starts thinking about his life from the outside. Fiction gives us a way of thinking about our lives from the outside. It becomes a kind of safe demon land. And in Goat Mountain, my new novel, I talk about Cain and Abel and the legacy of a first stopping being animals, the first time we have consciousness and a sense of shame, and the first Cain being the first to have understood things too late, that tragic Greek tragedy sense of living our lives out of control. So I think that all of my novels and these stories initially are exaggerated a bit and are hellish landscapes. They're the natural end of tragedy is the inferno, I think, trying to find some landscape of our badness, some externalization of our landscape of our badness, but told in this safe demon land, that this is where we can manage it. You know, in a therapy session, you might feel safe being able to manage it, but art also creates a place to go as far as you can go into what's most ugly, what's most animal, what's most unforgivable and most shameful. It's a chance to air all that out, to give it the light of day, and also to do something to it. It's not just a passive discovery or trying to find it. It's also transforming it. It's watching it change shape and become something else. And that's the important part, I think, is that this hell landscape, it's not just a representation, externalization of what's inside, but it's also has done something with what's inside and has changed it in some way.
And change is what we hope these podcasts will do for your practice too. Many thanks, David Vann, for speaking to me at Small Wonder, and thank you, Neve Pierce and Diana Reich, for getting us together, and also thank you, Alison McLeod at Chichester, for inviting us to talk. Bye.